a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3577 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Monday, so it's a Just Jack show. And today we're going to take kind of an upbeat look at the future, I guess. A solutions-based look at the future. We're going to talk about 12 decentralized technologies. And just checking over here to see if things are working on Rumble, because Rumble gave me hell today. But yeah, they are. Okay, so I do see you guys on Rumble as well. Those that are listening to the audio, this will be a show where you won't miss much by not being in the video side of the podcast. But anyway, being a Monday, a lot of times Mondays are my dark days, right? Like, I come out on a Monday and all kinds of shit accumulates over the weekend, and we do kind of a current events themed show, what's going on. And boy, do we have some crap going on right now with the election and all kinds of stuff. And no matter who wins, there's going to be disease, I guess, between now and Inauguration Day and even probably well past it, depending on how things go down. And due to that, we actually have kind of some dark shows coming this week. So tomorrow, it's a happy time because we're doing a partial, reunion of Unloose the Goose talent. I, Nicole Sauce, John Bush, and CJ Kilmer will be on. We're going to be kind of talking about all that stuff, though, kind of the lead up to the election, why it doesn't really matter who wins or whoever wins. We're still going to have problems, and we're probably going to have problems of a new level, no matter who wins, going into next year. And then on Wednesday, even though CJ's part of that reunion, CJ's coming on. It wasn't planned. It just worked out that way. He's coming on Wednesday, and we're going to talk about the fall of the Soviet Union, how that actually happened, why that actually happened, what it actually looked like, and corollaries to America today, especially from a financial strain and a discord standpoint. So those are going to be kind of darkish, and then we'll have an expert panel show. So I thought we needed something today that was a little more upbeat, a little less pessimistic. So what I've got for you are 12 decentralized technologies for navigating the future. And, you know, I'll talk a little bit more about this when we get into the meat of it. But I don't mean that these technologies can never have a centralized model. I mean, you can never prevent them from being used in a decentralized way. So, and they all have ways that they can help us and improve our life in areas like our economics, our food security, our communication capability, our water security, our health and sanitation, our energy. Doesn't that sound a lot like the things that we actually talk about all the time, like to survive and thrive if times get tough or even if they don't? I mean, that's what the show's really all about. And all of these technologies enable us in some way or another to do one of those core things or some other thing that actually has a lot to do with our ability to survive and thrive. And many of them actually hit on multiple areas. So they might have an economic component to them. They might have a food security component to it and maybe a health and sanitation component to it. And we'll talk about all of that today in just a minute. Before we do, I want to remind you about our sponsors today. Our sponsors do a lot to help make sure the show is here for you Monday through Friday, 5 days a week. And today's sponsor of the day, number one today, is Start9 Servers. I really think this is a perfect sponsor for today, and it is why I selected them as one of today's sponsor. We're going to talk about some stuff to do with kind of open source technology and things like that today. And Start9 is kind of like a whole bunch of open source technology in a box that lets you run it. If you can install apps on a cell phone and use them, then you can use a Start9 server. You can have end-to-end encrypted private messaging and only with the people that you allow in to use the service that you run on your own Start9 server. You can run a Bitcoin node. We're going to talk a little bit about Bitcoin technology today, as you might have expected. But you can also run your own payment gateway with something like BTC Pay Server, or run your own Lightning node with a Start9 Embassy server. You can have access to your documents no matter where you go. You can basically take back control of your life. And if you're an MSB member, you can get 9% off everything at Start9. And if you stack that, because you're a Fold card user, and get a gift card to buy your Start 9 stuff with and go through that angle, you get another 9%. That back in Bitcoin, so you get 18% off by stacking those things together, stacking something we will be talking about a little bit today as well. Next up today, JM Bullion. JM Bullion is the place that I go whenever I want to stack more silver and or gold, because they are a company that has sponsored this show for more than 10 years, which is already a big deal in the world of podcasting. To have anybody stay with you for a decade is kind of crazy. They also have better pricing than like Monex, Apmex, Lear Capital for the same silver or the same gold, which is kind of the point with silver and gold, is it's all the same. If you're an MSB member, they give you a discount. And on top of it, all your orders ship free. So I really don't know why you would go with anybody other than JM Bullion when it comes time to stack silver and gold. And it also fits well with our topic today, because once you have and you possess silver and gold, you can exchange it with other people. I don't even care what the government says about it. There's really no way to prevent that. It's between you, me, and the fence post if it's the three of us having a transaction. It's also an anonymous form of wealth that can be handed down to your heirs. You don't need to even put, if as long as they know where to get it when you're gone, you don't even need to put it in your will. You can just leave it. There it is. It's theirs. And that's between you and your lawyers and everything else. But my point is, silver and gold are a great way to hold wealth and a wealth assurance policy to make sure that if you ever need that wealth, some of it will still be there for you. All right. With that, let's go ahead and get on into it and talk about these various forms of decentralized technologies. And I want to start off with what I mean by decentralized technology, because some of the things I'm going to say today, you're going to be like, well, you could centralize that. If we talk about solar energy, for instance, there's plenty of centralized solar power right now that's then distributed to the grid and sold through the electric companies. That's true. But what prevents you from going out and acquiring the equipment and putting in solar power on your property? And the answer is nothing, unless you live in like a Karen hellhole HOA. And that's a different problem. That is not about whether or not the technology is centralized or decentralized. See, there's many things that we can't do. And even if we can, it's not very practical to put it out and say that like the average person could if they wanted to. For instance, the refining of oil, right? Refining oil into gasoline is not something somebody's going to do in their backyard. And the reason I couched it with the average person is somebody somewhere will show me somebody doing it, right? Or even taking it to another level and like making like some sort of biodiesel and then actually making it usable diesel in their truck, making it from algae and swimming pools or something. But this, again, is not something that really lends itself to truly being a distributed, open source, decentralized technology. So what I mean is simply that anybody could do it. And no matter how much they create a centralized version of it, we can still have our own decentralized version of it. I also want to talk a little bit about what I mean by technology. I think that in today's day and age, when I say technology, you think of something that has to have circuit boards and capacitors and resistors and transistors in it and chips and you know, all kind, like some sort of high level of technology. But technology doesn't mean that. That would be high technology or electronic technology or computerized technology. Technology is simply innovation that humans use to accomplish something by assembling things in a way that it takes some ingenuity to understand and do. So like an incredibly low form of technology, but yet one that had a huge impact on humankind, was the atlatl, right? So you have a spear. The spear itself was a technology, by the way. The way the point was made is a technology. The way sinew wrapped around the head of the spear is a technology. And if a Clovis point or what have you had its own like flute to it, that's a type of it. So all of those are technologies. If we're making something more like an arrow for small game and we're simply hardening the point, you put fire, that's technology. But then we take something like an atlatl, and that is a different level of technology, because now it takes the same thing that was already invented, this spear, and it lets you throw it faster and more accurately. That is a technology. A chimpanzee who figures out to take a stick and poke it inside the termite mound so the termites attack it, pull it out and eat the termites, that's technology. So we're not going to go that low tech today, but I'm just kind of pointing out. And yes, somebody's getting it here. Matthew's getting it, right? a hammer is a technology. Correct. A hammer and hand tools in general are technologies. And then the ability to build a hammer is a technology. The ability to fabricate the thing for yourself is a form of technology. To tool make is a technology. If you go back to old school wood craftsmanship, and I'm not necessarily talking about carpentry of people that frame out a house. I'm talking about people that are master woodworkers, where you would go work for somebody and apprentice with them and learn to make like cabinetry and things like that. The first thing that apprentice would make is actually a workshop desk. Right? I'm talking a work table. There's a word I'm missing here and it won't come to me right now, but basically the workbench that you would use to do all your work with, things that would allow you to like hold down material. If you've ever seen one of these old school style workbenches, woodworker bench. Yes, bench. Everybody's saying bench now. Yeah, I got there eventually, guys. It's Monday. I'm tired. It's been a long weekend. We've been working really hard to get ready for the event through these weekends recently, and this was no exception. But, yeah, your workbench, you would make that first, and then you would use that workbench in all the things that the master craftsman was teaching you as their apprentice. And so that is a technology as well. So the other thing is none of this is magic. All of these are simply tools, and different people will use the same tool different ways or better or worse than other people around them. And that means that they will only aid us if we grab onto them and use them. And part of with that is to realize not everybody's going to do everything. So if I go through this and you're like, well, I like one, I like three, I like four, I like five, and I like eight, and I don't like the rest of them, Jack, I don't want to do that, then don't do that. My point is that these are so accessible to so many people that enough of us can be doing them, that this dovetails nicely into last week's show about can we really build a parallel society and parallel economy. These are gateways to doing that. But yet, what makes this show different from a practical standpoint from that show last week on parallel societies is you don't have to have a parallel society to benefit from this. If you use some of these technologies, not all of them, but some of them, and you make your life more stable and better, it doesn't matter what anybody else does. So that's the beauty of decentralized tech. While we can use it to build community, to build businesses, to build networks, etc., much of it we can just simply choose to use for ourselves, for our families, for our friends, etc. All right, so let's start off with these 12 technologies. My number one, and I'm not going to go deep into any of them today because, you know, we have to get the show done in a reasonable amount of time, and I'm starting later today than normal because, again, it's a Monday. But number one is remote education and learning. And this can take on a variety of forms. Right now, my granddaughter is sitting with her grandma at our kitchen table and going through their writing class today using a platform called Excellus, which I've talked about many times. So this is an actual accredited school, K-12 school. And when they graduate from that school, 12th grade, and they have a high school transcript, it'll look like any other transcript from any other high school. But it's really a way to homeschool and have structure supplied for you. So that is a decentralized education model. And it's even inside the centralized system because over 6,000 public schools, government schools, in the country right now use Excellus at some level inside the public institution. But yet we're using it right here. And I've got hundreds and hundreds of you guys who have emailed me since we started using them and my audience that are using them too. So there's just a perfect example there. Can you centralize education? Yeah. Can you centralize remote education? Sure you can. But can you centralize it to the point where the average person can't use it, access it, participate in it? No. Now, of course, with Excellus, that's because they chose to make this a decentralized model to allow anybody that wanted it to buy it, which included even the people they're competing with. And you know you have a good product when your competitors buy from you. You know you really do. But is Excellus the only platform? See, if it was, it would be even in a decentralized distribution. It would still be a centralized model. There's only one place to do it. There's multiple schools that operate on this model now. And some of them are big, huge institutions. Harvard has a remote accessible degree program where you can, if you want to spend $40,000 a year to attend Harvard on your computer, you can do that. But we also have, you know, areas like the Great Courses is one platform, or Udacity, or in other ways that we can make education more distributed. We have things like OutSchool. We use OutSchool all the time. I told several teachers who are tired of teaching and looking to have like some part-time income now that they've left teaching about OutSchool and the programs you can set up there. So OutSchool is more like an a la carte one-off or individual courses, really for kids, not really for adults. But because there's so many educators there that on every subject, from fun stuff to hardcore academics, we've been able to use it, for instance, like this. Braylon gets somewhere with the mathematics he's starting to do now. He's 13. He's getting into some algebra and some like pre-calc and stuff like that. And I can figure it out, but it's been a long time. And I'm also going to teach it different than it's being taught today. And I have a job. And my wife can only go so far with that. So when he gets to a point where we realize like he's struggling, and you know how math is, if you remember math from school and you didn't do well in it, if you miss something and they go on without you, even if you seem to adapt and be okay, sooner or later they're going to get to something that went back to that thing you're supposed to know how to do, and you're lost. So we've been able to just reach out on OutSchool and get him a tutor for mathematics. And we might buy like 2 hours of that person's time, and they might meet with him 30 minutes in 4 different days, and then we're done. So that's another way that that can be leveraged. Of course, I run homefoodsystems.com. That's an online educational platform that teaches you about all sorts of things in the world of regenerative agriculture, permaculture, and homesteading. And I built that myself. Who did I ask permission from to do that? What you know, grant body or agency or whatever did I go to and say, sir, if it pleases the crown, may I please educate my followers? No. Right? How many people have YouTube channels that are primarily educational? They don't even charge anything. And it's all over the spectrum of what you can gain now. People today can learn faster and learn more with less money and less time and less effort than any time in history. And we still seem to think it's necessary to fix the dying, archaic, dinosaur-laden slavery shitholes that are the classic education system. Well, there's nothing classic about it, by the way. That's not a good word for it. Classic education would be the Trivium and a few other things, right? The legacy education system that's designed to condition people to listen and obey the clock, the time clock, and be just smart enough to do the job you qualify for, but not so smart as to be asking questions about why it's being done the way it's being done. Why are we trying to fix the failed system when we have a completely new system that's immediately adaptable to just about all of our needs? Now, if you want to be a doctor, I would suggest that you actually, like, for instance, in Gross Anatomy, dissect a cadaver instead of do it online. I get, for now, by the way, if you don't think we're going to get with like virtual reality, holographic technology and stuff to the point where you don't even need that, well, we will, but probably not anytime that soon. But there is so much that can be done with this current model. And again, I want to talk about how some of this stuff will stack with each other and link together and build on each other. So if you can use this education model, you can use it to learn. You can use it so your children can learn. But if you have something to teach, you can monetize it and prove yourself economically, right? So there's different ways that any one of these technologies can actually improve your life. You can be the teacher or the student or the teacher and the student. And things like artificial intelligence only up that. Because the problem we have with artificial intelligence right now is it's not intelligence at all. It is artificial. It's conversational. But you have to know enough to know when it's telling you something that's not quite right so that you can go further with it and figure out whether you've gotten the right information or not. So to me, that's actual real education. I never get upset. And I mean, I never get upset when somebody questions something that I've said, right? Unless they're being an asshole about it. Like, you're so stupid. I can't believe a guy with only one eye who thinks he's smart enough. Like, if you're that person, I don't give a shit. But when somebody's like, Jack, you said this thing, and I don't know if it's true or not. Hey, I'm going to analyze that. Maybe I misspoke. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm right. Maybe it's a combination where I'm right, but in the context of what you're objecting to, you're right. It's always possible, right? So there is so much opportunity here with remote education. It's one of the most powerful tools that we have, and one of the most powerful tools the state has in controlling society is the belief that they have falsely convinced us of, that we need them for it. We don't need them for it. Moving on. Let's go. So we don't need the state to educate us, and we really don't. Especially, if you're talking about advanced engineering and shit like that, okay, I get some form of institution, some form of in-person learning. But the K-12 general, every child should have a basic education type of education. The state has no role in this anymore if we just simply willed it so. There's 100 ways using that as a piece that we could eliminate the state. Well, another thing we've always believed we need the state for is to create and manage the money supply. This is actually really stupid because for about the first 100 years of this country, our country didn't even have a real U.S. dollar. We used the Spanish piece of 8 silver because silver is silver, and a known quantity piece of silver exists in the marketplace independent of the government and doesn't require the government for it to be an article of trade. I mean, the original way this country got into minting money was that we actually created mints where you could take your silver or gold that you had gotten out of your mining and your prospecting to them and have it minted in such a way that when you used it, it could be, you didn't have to go to the guy in the store that weighed it and, you know, figure out how many carats of gold it was and they exchanged it for some, you know, paper script from a bank for you or something like that. You had it and now you could use it. And then you paid for that service with a portion of the metal. That's how we started minting money as a country, right? That's how the first U.S. silver coinage came to be, was as these big, you know, these big mining operations in places like Utah, Nevada, and Arizona, right, where we started making these coins. So what do you think I'm going to talk about that's decentralized, available to anybody that really wants to partake in it, that gets rid of the states, you know, being required for money? Well, Bitcoin. And if you want to say crypto, you go ahead, right? I'm not going to ever crap on anybody because you're still into shit coins, because I was for a long time. I was for a really, really long time. Jen, I have two eyes, but one of them's blind. That's why my left eye just kind of goes off into oblivion at times. So I was making a joke about myself there. But yeah, Bitcoin mining and Lightning payments and everything that goes along with, you know, owning Bitcoin, using Bitcoin, mining Bitcoin, all of it is, I'm putting in one bucket today because I'm not just trying to make the list as long as possible. But we should be using this. And if you have a business, you should be accepting Bitcoin as Lightning payments and Bitcoin as Bitcoin. Whether anybody does it or not, you should set it up and you should make it so that it can be done instantly if you're ever cut out by the banking system, because they will. Because it's not just the minting and management and control of the monetary supply that we've relied on the state for in this unholy, dare I say, fascist alliance between the banking system and the state. We also have abdicated the ability to actually control our own money and how it flows. So you think, if I say to you, how much money do you have in the bank? It's a trick question, because you'll say something like, I don't know, $700, $7,000, whatever it is, in your, you know, your general checking and savings, not your retirement or your larger savings, maybe if you have like a sizable savings account for things like a 90-day emergency fund or whatever. And I would say to you, see, the reason it's a trick question is it's not money and it's not yours and it's not in the bank. It's an accounting assessment that you have access to that amount of money that's not actually money, it's actually debt certificates. And the bigger problem, like, I don't want to get into how stupid our monetary system is, because it really is. Our fiat monetary system of today is probably the dumbest and smartest economic system ever created at the same time. The dumbest because it allows us to be victimized at will by a centralized authority anytime that they want to. The smartest because it allows us to be victimized at will by a centralized authority anytime that they want to. And they actually made it work now for over 100 years and in its current form for over 50 years. You can't say it doesn't work because the current form that we've been working with has been in place since 1971. Well, it's failing, I agree, but it's still working, and it's probably still going to work for a lot longer. And they'll probably come up with some way to rebase it and keep it going for longer than you and I are going to be alive. So it's not just that it's an inflationary system that even if you save your money in a box, the value of your money keeps being robbed from. It's that they are going to eventually clamp down on cash to where it's going to be very difficult to use cash. It's getting harder and harder to use cash. And the larger the purchase, the more that that's true. Right now, you want to go to the grocery store. You spend $350 on groceries. Let's say $340, so you whip out three hundreds and a 50. They give you a $10 bill back. You go on your way. It's not really a problem. Go try to buy a car like that. Walk into a car dealership, and they're like, the car's $34,595. I'm paying cash. You know what they just heard? I'm going to write you a check. That's what they just heard. I'm going to write you. Walk in there with a briefcase of money and see what happens. I mean, there are some places you might get it done, but you're going to have so much analysis thrown at you, it really would have just been easier to put it in the bank and run it through the bank anyway. So it always – see, you got to see a corollary here. Right now they're talking about – the Harris people are talking about a wealth tax, and you hear all the – like Elizabeth Warren and their ilk, Bernie Sanders always talking about a wealth tax. Well, a wealth tax is taxing unrealized gains. That's what it actually is. It's to say that Elon Musk is worth $800 billion, so he should pay 1% of that every year. But most of that wealth, that value, is in stock that's never been traded. So therefore, you'd have to sell it. It's just an absolute mess, right? There's no real way to make that work, but they want to tax wealth. And so how are they going to sell you on the wealth tax? It only applies to people worth over $100 million. That's exactly how they're trying to sell people on it right now. Well, what happens once you get something in that only applies to people over $100 million? Well, then they say, well, you know, I don't know, man. People that are worth like $50 million, that's pretty wealthy too, yeah? And then eventually they keep lowering the metric, and at the same time as they devalue the money, the average net wealth of people that have any wealth keeps going up in the bottom line number. So if you think about it this way, like the first income tax, it only applied to like 1% of people. And I think the threshold was like $30,000 a year in income or something like that. Well, today people that, you know, go welcome to Walmart, here's your cart, welcome to Walmart, I love you, right? They make that much money. And so that's the game that's always being played. So when they say, well, you know, we just can't have these cash purchases of like cars and houses. Well, that's where it always starts. And there's a war on cash. So they're going to take away cash. That's your one option you have now to operate with the system, outside the system at the same time, because I have control of my cash. You can't shut it off. There is a real propensity in the future for either your money to be shut off on you or more likely for it to be controlled. I don't want you buying this thing, so I'm just not going to let you. And I think what you'll see first is restrictions like, well, we can all agree that the earth is going to blow up and burn to death because of carbon. No, we can't all agree with that, but they'll say it anyway. And they'll say, you know, so there's certain activities that you partake in that expand your carbon footprint, and they'll like, you have all the money you want. Spend your money on anything you want, except in these categories. There's so much potential like that, which hurts the buyer and the seller both. Think of it like free speech. Free speech is a two-sided coin. It is not just my right to say what I have to say. It is not, now, I have no inherent right to be heard. But the people who want to listen to me have an inherent right to be able to hear. Well, when it comes to monetary exchange, I should have every right to spend my money, and you should have every right to receive it and exchange that item back with me. And so Bitcoin gets us around that. Plus, when we look at mining, we can. This is something that, again, not everybody's going to do, but anybody that wants to can learn how to run a Bitcoin miner. And once you can mine, you can start tying into other systems. Like if you run solar or wind and you've got your batteries at capacity for the day, and now you're just generating electricity, you could be mining Bitcoin with it, or you could be using a Bitcoin miner as a heater. And there's a lot of other things you could be doing, but we'll leave it at that today. We went long enough on it. Next up, the next three, I'm going to tell you straight up, I have classes either on them or coming on all of them. And yes, that's kind of promotional for me, but there's a reason that I made classes on them in the first place, and this is part of why. So the next decentralized technology that I believe can enhance our food security a great deal and can be centralized and can be industrial and can be broad scale, but also can work in a garden in a backyard, is cover cropping. See, plants don't give a shit about who says what about them. You know, you can Monsanto, now Bayer, can say whatever they want about their GMO canola, and you have to pay a license and a fee to grow it. And not that I want to, but that GMO canola, when it goes to seed and drops seed somewhere else, it grows wherever the fuck it wants to. It doesn't give a shit what Bayer has to say. You go ahead and sue Mother Earth. Good luck. They probably will figure out a way to do that next. But plants don't care. And plants do what plants do. And one of the things that plants do really well is they take carbon out of the atmosphere, and they don't just use it for photosynthesis directly for their own energetic needs. They actually pump carbon from the atmosphere into the soil. And the number one thing that you can do to your soil to grow healthier and more sustainable plants is put carbon in. If you're putting carbon into the soil actively with living, healthy plant root interactions, then you're building biology. Like, one does not happen without the other. And if we add some of the other stuff to it, like really good quality compost and all, we only turbocharge that. But if you want to think about how powerful cover cropping is, so you can go look at an average farm field in the spring after it's been plowed, then it's been planted. And if you don't get rain at the exact right time and you get a windstorm in, I guarantee you that farm area is going to end up looking like the Dust Bowl from the 1930s. Those of you who have taken my cover crop class, you know that it is the first or the second chapter. I have a slide in there, and it's from 2023. And anybody looking at that slide, if you said it's, you'd be like, oh, it's colorized from like 1934 or something. You'd be sure that's what it was. No, it's from last year. And something as simple as putting some seed down at the right time, because there's always timing involved in these things. So we've harvested the crop, we immediately sow some other seed that's very inexpensive, and we don't lose valuable topsoil, and we get a healthier next year crop. And that's at an industrial scale. When you look at what it costs to cover crop, let's say 10 garden beds in your backyard, it's about $10. I'd say it's right around, it's probably less. I've never really even done the math. It's so small a cost that I consider it inconsequential to the whole. But about $1 a bed for a good mixture of seed, because you're talking an average bed being like 4x8 or maybe 4x16 even, you could probably do for $1. Who can prevent you from doing that? Who can prevent you from going down to the feed store and buying, you know, even out of a loose seed bin from a conventional feed store and buying enough seed to do your winter cover crop right now, which you should be doing? No one. And this is one of those things, I will be a little self-promotional. If you take my course, you'll understand how powerful that is. You'll understand. Those of you who have taken the course, you know that it is not just, hey, take these 10 seeds and throw them on the garden. It gives you a complete understanding of the entire biological process that's going on. And cover cropping is thousands of years old. It was done in Egypt. It was done in Mesopotamia. It was done in Samaria. It was done in ancient China. And it is a definite technology. Fitting the same place, composting. Composting is one of the most powerful technologies known to man, and there's 1,000 ways to do it. And, of course, my course teaches a type of composting called bioreactor composting. And I do believe that of all the methods of composting, it is the best method for the most people in the most situations. I'm not going to necessarily say it's the best overall all the time for everything. Worm composting is pretty awesome. Black soldier fly composting is pretty awesome. I had a guy email me probably 4 months ago, and he said, hey, I just hooked up with this dude that's now a manager at like a Jamba Juice. I don't think it was a Jamba Juice. It was something like that, a juice bar. And I can get something like 50 pounds of pulp a day. I want to make bioreactors. And I'm like, no, you don't. That's all nitrogen. It's pure nitrogen. Like, you'll never get enough carbon to balance it in that model. You want, like, fruit pulp? You want black soldier flies and vermicompost. In fact, you want to kind of create a chain of the two of them working together. So now what you're able to do is take a waste product that's free and turn it into a resource with ecological, biological, and economic value to it. If you can get a waste, like that's one store. Can you imagine if that guy, even with just low tech, like 100-gallon Rubbermaid tubs, like the black and yellow ones, and built a row of freaking black soldier fly houses, how much black soldier fly frost he could produce, and what you take the frost, you feed that to worms. What's the value of that? And if you're smart, you don't sell that as worm compost. You don't just sell it as worm compost. You market that whole process. This is black soldier fly frost fed to worms. It's turbocharged, right? And you throw something like biochar into it and some other additives. You have a premium shippable product that, you know, you don't want it soaking wet and you don't want it bone dry. But if it's damp and not overly wet, it's fairly light for the amount that you'll ship. And you've got a product you can sell both locally now or nationally. I wouldn't even try to do that internationally. But, I mean, how much bigger of a market do you need? Plus, you have the resource for your own use. So that's even though I'm teaching bioreactor composting, because most people can get large amounts of carbon with moderate amounts of nitrogen somehow somewhere where they are. And since so many of us in this community are homesteaders with chicken, duck coops, horse barns, et cetera, like it's just the bedding that's in there and the manure that ends up with it and you're there. And that's why I say for the most people, but there's plenty of different ways to compost. We can compost in ways that are like more of, instead of a bioreactor, more of like a pit model biodigester that can actually produce gas. If we have gas, we can burn gas. If we can burn gas, we have heat. If we have heat, we can make other forms of energy out of it, or we can do something with that energy like cook. You start to realize how this all ties together. There's no reason that same person, if they wanted to go another route, couldn't build massive biodigesters, build a generator type setup that can run off that, and then mine Bitcoin with it. And then take the heat from the Bitcoin mining and start up a beef jerky business. Who knows, right? Like, I'm just saying, if you're thinking there's like five other ways to tie this together, yes. Yes. That is an absolute reality that there's countless ways to tie this together. That's why I'm doing this show. And that's why I'm staying high level today instead of going deep down into any of them. Next then is biochar. And to me, and this is why they were the first three courses. I'm doing the biochar right now. Cover cropping, composting, biochar. That's the core that I'll be teaching for the rest of my life on how to be productive on a small farm, a backyard garden, a small pasture system. I don't care. It's all doable with those combined together. But the biochar thing is, and I say things like, at times I'll say something like with politics, all anarchists are libertarians, but not all libertarians are anarchists. In fact, I get really pissed off when people insinuate that everybody who identifies as a libertarian is an anarchist, not because I don't wish for it to be true, because it's not. There's plenty of libertarians that are for small, controlled government, where the anarchist is for no government. Yeah? But every anarchist is a libertarian, because all anarchism is pure libertarianism. So when you think about this, all biochar is charcoal, but not all charcoal is biochar. To me, what makes biochar is that it's completely removed of all its volatiles, and that's why when it's dry, it sounds like glass when you drop it onto itself, and when you get it on your hands, you can rinse it off. That doesn't mean it's not charcoal. It just means it's really pure, really good charcoal. At that point, I don't even consider it biochar. I don't consider it biochar until biology is introduced to it. When you make it in your compost, when you put it through an animal, when you inoculate it with something like a mixture of human urine and kelp meal liquid seaweed, or when you mix it with compost and give it 3 weeks before you apply it, when it gets charged up, that's when it becomes biochar. So even though I'm saying biochar, what I want to start out with is a decentralized technology, and it's used as a decentralized technology all over the world right now. It's just charcoal. I mean, you can make charcoal better than you can buy from scrap wood around you everywhere. The waste streams you can tie into just for making what we think of as charcoal, you know, whether we use it as biochar or cooking charcoal or something else, what I mean is hard and soft woods, are everywhere. I guarantee you, if you don't live right in the middle of urban America, if you live anywhere, suburbs, out, if you get in your vehicle and you randomly drive around, you will find piles of brush sitting there waiting to be turned into biochar that right now are like fire hazards. And maybe they're providing some habitat for animals, but they also might be providing like habitat for animals you don't want where that is, like that's where all the rats live or something. Or it's a farm and you got brush piles and they're full of rabbits that come out and eat your vegetables. There is so much waste material right now available that we have no need to ever cut down anything specifically and only for the purpose of making biochar. If you get into your, you know, I guess they don't have phone books anywhere. I was about to say phone book, aging myself there. But if you start looking up around you, the online equivalent of the phone book of the 1980s, and you look for cabinet makers and furniture makers and things like that around you, I guarantee you there are waste streams right now that all you have to do is go once a week and pick it up, and they'll give you more than you can handle. And most of that is going to be hardwood, kiln dried, all ready to go, and already cut into reasonably sized pieces. There was a guy I met in Tennessee last year, and he was making biochar in just a 55-gallon drum cut in half with the end bent over. That's all that he did, and it worked perfectly, as good as any cone kiln I've ever seen. But I'm looking at the material, and I'm like, that looks like really great material. And I picked it up, and I was like, is this ash or oak? He goes, it's ash. I'm like, this is – and they're little spindles, about 4 inches long and, you know, about as – you know, I don't know, about as – not quite as big as your wrist, but bigger than your thumb, somewhere in between. And they're all, like, relatively the same size. I'm like, what the hell is this? He goes, they're cutoffs from a company that makes baseball bats. And he was, I think, from Kentucky. He had driven down to Tennessee for SRF. And he said he went by this place once a week, you know, and they're not like Louisville Slugger or something like that. But they make a lot of bats. And I think he was getting two, like, industrial-sized garbage cans a week. You don't have to do anything. Just make charcoal out of it. And you could make a cooking charcoal, you could make a charcoal for any use, or you could make biochar with it, which is what he's doing. That's just one example. Bob Wells up in New England, he's getting just basically cut off from a furniture factory. And, you know, he has to have a truck and a trailer to pick it up. He's getting so much. And they were spending thousands of dollars a month to pay for it to go away, because they're in an urban area and they can't just get rid of it. You can't just go out on the county road and throw it out. So it's all the end cutoffs and stuff. He's getting them from sawmills. There is an infinite amount of waste material. You can make biochar from some of the waste material that comes out of the coffee industry. You can make biochar from nut husks. So there's an entire industry there that can be tied into. So there's just so much shit that people are throwing away, and you can turn it into an economic viable a product with economic viability or for direct use on your homestead. When I read the book 1491, America Before Columbus, and they tell the story of I can't remember who it is now that went down the Amazon, first white person anyway, to go from basically Western South America to the Atlantic Ocean across the Amazon, they actually had a point where they didn't have enough boats, basically, whenever they would find materials that they could, you know, steal or haul, because sometimes they would find wild materials, sometimes they were basically stealing it, they needed more capacity. And they literally figured out how to make nails so they could build a boat by smelting iron from deposits that they found along the way, which is great, like build their own bellows and shit. But if you want to make something like that, you can't do it with just wood. You need charcoal. The entire Bronze Age, right? The entire Bronze Age would have never happened without the discovery of how to make charcoal, which way predated it. There's medical uses for it. So I don't want to keep going here, but I'm just telling you that this is an incredible technology that mankind has had for thousands of years. There's hundreds of ways to actually make charcoal, and there's tons of things you can do. And I'll give you one more and we'll move on. So when we come to making biochar, one of the ways that we do that is, or one kiln type, it's called a tin man retort. And basically you have a 55-gallon drum, and this has air holes. It can breathe. And you have a 30-gallon garbage, 30-gallon barrel that has almost no hole, very little pinholes on the top to let gas out so you don't make a bomb. Okay, and we take the 30-gallon one and we fill it up. We put it inside the 50-gallon one, and we stack material all the way around the walls of it. And then we put some on the top, we light it, and as it burns down, it gets good airflow, it gets going, it heats the stuff up in the 30-gallon barrel, and then as it off-gasses, the gas coming off the wood that's going to become charcoal actually provides the fuel to carbonize itself. It's pretty cool. And the beauty of these like retort systems like that, unlike an open pit burn, is everything kind of stays the way it is. You can like throw a big giant like beetle the size of your hand in there and it'll come out like a museum piece unless you crush it. Well, let's say that, you know, one of the technologies I didn't talk about in here that I would, and I'd say there's a lot of technologies that go with it, would be backyard livestock. That's a technology. That's why I included it in last week's show about parallel societies, being able to grow your own food. Well, one way you would do that is what? Fodder trees. Okay. And I do see questions coming in right now, and I'm going to star both of them, and that's the way to do them right there, the word question in all caps, and I'll see if I can see them. So anyway, willow is a great fodder. Willow grows nice and straight, especially if I prune it in a way to encourage lots of whips to grow. Now, shut up, geese. Geese are decentralized technology, too. That's my goose alarm. When we harvest that willow, as fodder for, let's say, rabbits, they'll eat some twigs and sticks and all, but you really don't want to be feeding, like, as a mainstay to, like, your animals, let's say, the whips that are about as big as your thumb or a little bit bigger. But what if you cut a whole bunch of them nice and straight at the length of that 30-gallon barrel, you fill that 30-gallon barrel up instead of just randomly throwing crap in there as a feedstock, once in a while anyway when you're making char, and you end up with, like, 3 foot long, perfectly straight pieces of charcoal, which you then break down into roughly 6 inch long. What do you have? You have artisan made artist charcoal. What do you think you can sell that for? I don't know, but I'm betting you can sell it for a pretty good bit of money. Matthew says he's going to be trying to make one called a hookway retort. I think that is one of the coolest designs ever, and I'm looking into maybe how we could be, you know, Paul Wheaton for Rocket Mass Heaters, which would be another thing that could be on my list, but it's not. They have what's called a shippable core. So the actual thing that has to be right, I'm wondering if, and I'm hoping by the time my charcoal course is done, somebody in this audience, kind of an engineering mind, will be able to take everything I put together and then maybe even develop some things we don't have yet. Because if a hookway retort were done right, which is basically like a 55-gallon drum with a rocket stove in the middle of it, that's basically what a hookway is. And the way it's done right now, it wouldn't really work in a greenhouse, but it could be easily modified. It also has another weakness I won't get into right now that could be easily solved, the problem with a simple modification. So I think there's going to be ways that we can monetize things like charcoal making beyond making the charcoal, by empowering other people to make the charcoal, right? I mean, that's I can see some of the guys that right now are big in IMO, and they're so big on the IMO has to come from your backyard. Guys, not everybody's going to do everything. The end, finish, done. Well, when you get into something like IMO 2 and you've stabilized it, it'll ship and everything stays alive. And so I can see the IMO guys building IMO recipes and shipping maybe four or five different cultures that then can be brewed up and used to inoculate biochar. And partnerships form there. There's a lot of potential from that. But hey, I got to go on because this is one of those things I'm passionate about, so I can keep talking for way too long. How about hydroculture? What the hell is hydroculture? Water culture. So, again, I didn't try to make this list as long as possible, so I could break hydroculture into like 10 different things. But primarily what I'm thinking is hydroponics, aquaponics, and aquaculture. All three are variations upon working with water-based systems. But aquaculture is one of the most ancient food production systems in the world. And it primarily, like the best examples of it, come from some of the most ancient organized civilizations and society, which of course is what we think of today as Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Korea, Sri Lanka, down into the, like the Philippines, all the island nations, etc. And honestly, though, all the way back, there's aquaculture examples in ancient African cultures, in Europe, today what's like the Slovakian areas and things like that, tons of aquaculture. In Hungary, there was a system of aquaculture that revolved around three ponds, and there's very few of them left, but there's actually a few left today that involve growing young fish in one pond, growing fish out in their second season for harvest in the second pond, and the third pond actually being dry. And then that actually growing a kind of like a pasture mix that then livestock are fed on, and then that is reflooded, and each year the pond shifts. So pond one becomes two, and two becomes three, and three becomes one. And so there's just this ancient history. But when Bill Mollison would teach aquaculture, the aquaculture chapter in the permaculture design course, he would always talk about what we know from Asia to today. And I don't think it's that Asia has a more ancient tradition of aquaculture. It's that they didn't stop doing it. They didn't stop doing it. And what he says about, he's like, if you give a Chinaman a teacup full of water, he'll put a fish in it. That's the way he explains it. Now, that's obviously Bill being Bill and bullshitting a little bit. He was an older guy by the time he was using that analogy, but he was making a point. If you have a place that you can hold water on your property and you're not holding water on your property, then you're making a mistake. And if you could hold water on your property, then you could use the water before it's used for irrigation or evaporates or whatever else. So you should be doing that because it is the most productive systems in the world. Here's some examples. The most productive crop by square foot for production on planet Earth are water chestnuts. And if you have ever grown them, and it's as simple as if you have some sort of little backyard pond, I don't care if it's a koi pond, you can take a pot, right? Fill it up with good fertile material, a little bit of gravel in the bottom, holes in the bottom, stick it in there so it stays wet. Take one freaking water chestnut, stick it in the middle in the spring. And the only way to mess it up is to put like five of them in there, because I've done it. That chokes itself out. It's too productive. You put one in the middle of like a 2-foot by 1-foot pot, and in the fall, when they start to yellow back and they've set tubers, actually chromes, not really tubers, and you turn it upside down, you like almost wonder where the dirt went. It's just full of these things. Another incredibly productive aquatic plant is Aiopteryx aquatica. It's also known as like Kang Kong, Chinese water spinach, Vietnamese water spinach. It's the same family as sweet potato vine, except the stems and the leaves are edible. It doesn't produce a tuber. It's just in that family. It is so productive, it's considered an invasive species. And there's dozens of other examples. But if we have a water-based system, then we don't worry about drought. So we can take water from any system, including a pond that doesn't have enough nutrient to be used for something like aquaponics, and we can push it through wicking beds, either continuously or on a timer, once a day, once every other day. Now we don't have to water. Now we have a system with soil that never has the soil go dry, never has the soil get damaged. If we have water we can hold of any amount, then we should be growing fish. If you grow fish, you have one of the most productive protein sources known to man, because the fish doesn't have to hold itself up. It's effectively weightless in the water. So the feed conversion is really high. You're starting to see all this. Then what's the economic value? Well, every time that I take two catfish out of one of my ponds and Dorothy and I have dinner from the pond, I didn't buy food. That's an economic advantage. But, you know, and I don't really maximize this. I have other things that I do, but there's plenty of things you could be doing. I bought a really nice water lily, beautiful little yellow water lily that I grow. Like, it's like a dwarf. It's not really a dwarf. It's like a mid-size. And I put it in a pot, a little crumb, stuck in a pot. And last year I was pulling hunks. Like, I can't leave it all in there. Every piece that I broke off growing out of that pot and other pots that it spread to could have been sold. Water plants have value. Water gardens in this country are a massive industry. Go to Pond Plant Megastore and start looking up plants and see what they sell for. You see that the money is less in food and more in ornamentals, because in America, the people that have ponds in their backyards, if they're not actual like fishing ponds, when you're talking about like you call a company, they come put a pond in, it's not like Asia where you're growing food in it. Most of these people are, you know, just big old koi swimming around and stuff like that. But even those ponds could be harnessed this way. You can make, you know, combinations of them. Hydroponics is in this nest of technologies. I know some people don't like it. I don't really care. What I'm telling you is, with a small greenhouse and a few of these other things tied in, like if you were using biochar production to create heat to keep your greenhouse from freezing overnight, then you could probably get into farming for money with hydroponics for less money and more reliability than any other way. And I love aquaponics, but hydroponics lets you dial in exact amounts. And I know that we're going to get to a point in time where we're not even going to be for hydro dependent on chemical inputs. We're going to be able to use things like worm compost and things like that. And it really will be a form of aquaponics, maybe vermiponics. I'm not sure how to put it. But what we'll be able to do is have much more control over when we add nutrient, how we pull nutrient out. By the way, you want a great emergency nutrient sink for your aquaponic system? Put in an ebb and flow bed, okay? But don't use it. Fill it with biochar. At any point you go out, your fish are surface breathing. They don't just look right. You do a test. Nutrients a bit high. Kick that sucker on for 2 weeks. It'll pull the nutrient load right down. And when you're done doing that and you get everything balanced again, take that biochar, dump it out. Now use it as much charged. It's inoculated. Fill it back up with raw char. It's sitting there anytime you want. Like it. Instead of a battery on demand, a battery to draw. It's like having a battery in a system where if you're going to have too much electricity and it's going to start a fire, you could turn the battery charger on and start drawing the surplus energy into the battery so it's not wasted, but also so it doesn't overload the system. That's the way to think about it in aquaponics. But one way or another, involving water-based growing of food is a huge decentralized technology that we're not using enough. And if you think about some of the real pioneers in modern aquaponics, hydroponics and all, it was built for that reason. Think of Kratky Aquaponics, Kratky Hydroponics. So Dr. Kratky, who's still with us, he's a professor emeritus from the University of Honolulu, which basically means he doesn't get paid, but he still gets to be a professor the way that he wants to when he wants to. That's what that means. He's retired. Retired with a title and access to school resources. Yeah. But why did he make Kratky is a pumpless form of aquaponics, for those that don't know. Hydroponics. We put nutrient solution into a vessel, let's say a Rubbermaid tub. We put plants in it, and we let the water evaporate. And as the evaporation drops the water level, we have oxygen for our roots, so we don't need a pump. And then we can take, like, a large tank and a float valve and say, to hither thou shalt drop and no further, so that it never goes below a certain level. And then at the end of each cycle, we can then use that to like fertilize trees and then refill that tub and start over again. Well, he did that because it's decentralized. Whose permission do you need? What specialized thing do you can make float valves out of like an aspirin bottle. right? I mean, and in fact, I've seen him do it. I've seen him literally make a float valve out of an aspirin bottle, for instance, to manage an entire system with one valve. You put everything on level, you have one float valve, everything never gets below a certain level. Pretty cool. Pretty simple to do. Like, I've seen lots of ways that things like that can be done. So that's another decentralized technology. The next one I have is decentralized social media, alternative social media. Noster is like my premier example of this, but there's others, right? Like, you could say some that I would say are like halfway alternative. Rumble. Rumble's not really an alternative social media platform as far as like video distribution, because somebody owns Rumble, somebody makes the decision. By its very nature, it is centralized, but the odds that Rumble is going to take your video down because you said something that pisses off the establishment are much lower than whether or not these assholes on Google, YouTube right now where I am will take down content. I've had tons of my content taken down. I've never been given the opportunity to present my case to Google, ever, as to why my content's valid. I've never actually been given a satisfactory explanation as to what I did wrong. In some instances, I'm pretty sure I know what it was I said or did, but I had episodes that were taken down that I'm like, I really don't know. You know, violence or hate speech or some shit, right? That's not decentralized at all. So, you know, Rumble's in the middle. But something like Odyssey, you can say anything, do anything you want. And there's really, then like DTube, and there's these other video platforms and these other social media platforms that don't practice censorship. But when we look at something like Noster, it's not even possible. I can't delete my own shit on Noster. Once you put it up there, it's up there. If somebody wants to find it, they can find it. So you need to think about that. Now, what you can do with some of the clients is you can essentially hide it. So it won't show up. Somebody would have to know where to go find it to see it, but it's still there. And the beauty of that is if I can't take it down, neither can you and neither can the government, and nobody can. And we need these things. One, because like all this other stuff that I'm talking about, like, you know, remote education, we need a way to get it to people. We need a way to communicate. We need a way to do business with each other. Right now, you can get on Noster today. You can stop telling me all this bullshit about how you can't do it because it's too hard and it's too technical and I don't know and I got sand in my butt crack and now I'm going to cry and it's impossible and Jack is a genius and he can do things I can't, which is all bullshit, or you could do it. Once you do it and you link it to a Lightning wallet, you are tied into an existing network with an uncensorable payment network inside of it. And when I say it that way, it shocks me how many of you still haven't done it. I'm going to say it again, and then I'm going to shut up about it for the rest of this episode and for probably until like the end of the year. Okay, it is a network with uncensorable communication populated by tens of thousands of other people who you have something in common with by the very fact that they're there, with an integrated, uncensorable payment network that's already part of it. Why the fuck are you not on Noster? Seriously. Seriously. I know I said not everybody's going to do anything. If I said that to you, if I didn't tell you what it was, we have a social network that allows you to communicate with anybody else in an uncensorable way. Nobody can prevent it. And there's lots of people that are liberty-minded already there as an integrated payments network that also cannot be censored, where you can do business with anybody you want at any time, anywhere in the world, and no one can stop you. You're like, I'm in. It's Noster, no. It hasn't changed because I gave it a name. And it's not too hard because you tried and you couldn't do it. You tried, you failed. You know what you tried to do the first time you tried to do it? Shit in a toilet. Piss in a toilet. Wipe your own ass. Aren't you glad you didn't give up on those? Read. Write. Do math. Shoot a basketball at a basketball ghost. Some of you like me aren't that good at it yet, but at least you can do it. Catch a baseball. Tie your shoes. Write a letter. Okay? Ask somebody out on a date. Like, almost everything you've ever done in your life, the first time you did a shitty job at it, and it didn't work out well. The girl told you to get away from her, and you walk away, and you're like, oh, no, I'm never going to do it again. And then you realize, well, living alone sucks, so I'm going to figure out how to ask people out and do it in a way where I don't sound like a moron, right? like having somebody wipe my butt for me when I'm 1 year old, I guess that's kind of cool, actually. Like, I don't have to worry about nothing except rolling around like a baby. But eventually, like, I got to take care of that myself. Everything you've ever done was hard until you did it. This is no different. Go do it. Soapbox done for this. But we do need a way to communicate with people in a decentralized manner and a way to pay bills in a decentralized manner, the way to disseminate information and disseminate a decentralized manner. And I want you to tell me a better way. So use what we have. Moving on. Solar and wind. And this can be personal or like microgrids. Both of them. And this is something that I think is probably the least underutilized of everything that I'm talking about today. Many preppers, many self-sufficiency-minded folks, many permaculturists, many people who don't even think about the resiliency that comes from it get involved with solar because they think they're saving polar bears or it's going to cut their electric bill or what have you. So this one gets used a lot. But I think what we need to understand is how much more we could do with it with small scale. You know, I have one of my aquatic systems runs on solar. It's a direct drive pump hooked up to a couple solar panels on the roof of my duck house. Sun comes up, pump goes on, sun goes down, pump goes off. Doesn't even have a battery system with it. Doesn't have really an inverter. It's a 12 volt pump, 12 volt charge controller to a solar panel. Sun comes up, pump goes on, sun goes up, pump goes off. Simple. Simple. That's one example. I really struggle with all of you guys. Like, I get a question a week, if not more, about solar generators in spite of the fact that I've been crapping all over them for like 15 years and telling you there's no such thing as a solar generator. A generator is a thing you start it up, power on demand. That's a generator. No sun, no power, no generator. Okay? Sorry. And a little shitty generator. A little shitty two-cycle generator that's $200 or less for Sportsman's Guy will outperform that, you know, solar generator you paid $2,000 for or more. I'm sorry. But the concept isn't bad. All you're talking about is a portable, non-grid-tied solar power system. That's what a solar generator is. And you could go to Walmart and buy 6 marine batteries and, you know, then go to Walmart and buy, not Walmart, like Amazon and buy a charge controller, solar panels, an inverter, and some sort of case that you can actually move it around with because it's going to be heavy, and wiring and connectors, and you can build something that is 10 times better than anything you're going to buy for $1,000, $2,000. And that is a solar-powered system. And once you build that, you actually know how to do it for an off-grid cabin. You just build more. All you do is scale up. Put in more panels, put in more batteries, put in larger and more inverters. Put in a better charge controller at a higher, you know, you got to make sure everything fits in. We could be doing solar for a ton of shit that makes a lot of sense. And one of the things, and I picked this up from Sean Mills, and it was like, I already knew Sean when he said this. He had already been coming to workshops here and helping out in the community. But it was like the day, like, my understanding of his, like, stock value for the community was, like, way up. Like, I was undervaluing. If you know how to do this and you want land, there's a lot of land where grid power just isn't available. It's not going to happen. You're never going to get it. And most people would tell you, like, payback on solar is like 5 to 20 years, depending on a bunch of different variables. And Sean Mills said, well, if you do it right, your payback on solar can be one day. And I'm like, what in the hell is this lunatic talking about one day? One day. Like, there's a lot. You get 6 months, I'd be like, I don't know, but maybe. But one day, what kind of bullshit are you pulling, Sean? He said, okay, it's real simple. If you buy a piece of property that, let's say, would sell, if it had grid, they didn't have power on it, but it could get grid power, it would sell for $200,000, okay? And then you have another piece of property, and it's selling for $50,000. And even if you put, like, the most bad-ass solar solar generation equipment on it, possible. Big ass arrays, lots of batteries, everything. $50,000 you spend on that. And $50,000 will build a solar array that will do almost anything that you want to do within reason. Yeah. And now you bought a property that normally you would spend $200,000 for. You're actually not just broke even, you're ahead. You just paid $100,000 for a $200,000 property because you knew how to do something somebody else didn't. And sure, if you called up like mysolarwind.com or some shit that advertises on YouTube, probably will be advertising on this once it's not live and it becomes Memorex, you know, you'll see an ad probably. There's things they don't want you to know in Texas, like they're required to give you solar panels for free just if you show up and take a shit or some other lie they're going to tell you. And if they're going to do that ad right now, that's the lie they're going to tell you, and it's bullshit. And if you did hire a company like that, it might not be the case that you could put in that much power for that amount of money. But if you do the work yourself, or you hire more of like general level contractors to do the parts that are not complicated, but physically, like you need to set big poles or something like that. It doesn't matter what it's being done for. You're just hiring general labor. And you can get that work done for a fraction of what you would pay somebody to do it for you. You can go in with other members of this audience and buy solar panels by the pallet to save money. You can instantly make these systems pay for themselves. And if I have to explain how that works again, I don't know that you're ever going to understand it, but if I buy a property for $50,000 and I put $50,000 worth of solar on it, and that property's now a $100,000 property, but now I can sell it for $200,000. I might even flip the property, not even build on it. Use the money to buy another one and do it again. There's a lot of opportunity like that out there. If I can still sell under market value and the power's there, ready to be used. Yeah. Next up today is mesh networks. And this is the one that I know the least about. Now, we just did a show on mesh networks for radio systems, for LoRa radios, and that's a great example. But we're going to get to a point where mesh networks are going to become way more powerful. And I think that's why I want to play a little bit with like the LoRa radio mesh networks. I'm not really that interested in talking to a lot of people on LoRa radios or anything like that, but I want to experience it. For $200 worth of equipment and all, I can make a really premium addition to the network in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for people. So I'm going to do it just to help out. But there's going to be other forms of mesh networks. Start9 is working toward a day when everybody with a Start9 box can be part of a mesh network. We can basically create a secondary internet that we control instead of them. Now, how do we get to a point where, and Jesse, you're saying you just built a Meshtastic radio. Jesse, I think you're the one that emailed me about putting up a radio for me, the repeater and all. It was either you or Andy. If it was you, email me again on that because I really know, you know exactly what to buy, so I it's here. Because if that was you, I'll have you do it. If it's somebody else, I'll have them do it. But we need to get that in. But there's going to be other ways we're going to do mesh. And, you know, meshing like things like Start9 boxes, meshing together. And I see a point where we may be able to start meshing things together and tying in things like Noster with meshes. And then you've got integrated payment networks, integrated communications, and uncensorable tech. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. And we may also, like, one of the weaknesses we have with a mesh network is if you actually want to get onto what we think of as the internet, like you want to access Google, right, or some other search engine because you know Google sucks, or you want to be able to use social media, or you want to be able to watch videos that aren't hosted on a computer that's part of your network, what you have is basically an extended LAN in a mesh network. It's not the right word, but it's a good way to think about it. You have a local mesh, so kind of like a LAN, a local area network. You still don't have WAN in that you can't get outside of your mesh. So someone somewhere has to have a connection to the internet. That creates a bottleneck. That creates a censorship point. But I think that we will get to a point, you know, especially with people like Elon and Starlink, we may get to a point where they stop trying to do that because it doesn't work anymore. And here's a good way to think about that. If you were at least, let's say, in your teens, in the 1990s, you probably remember the days of things like Napster and LimeWire. And if you're in your 50s like me, you probably remember the days of sitting and listening to radio stations for that one song with the tape player, like the play record down and the pause button on. And you were trying to hear that first note or two, so you only lost a little bit of it. And click, and then you recorded that song. You stole it from the music industry, right? You stole it from Sony or whatever, or RCA. And then you had it for free. You could play it forever, or at least till the tape needed to be repaired. You couldn't fix it with a pencil anymore. And then damn DJ would come in, and he would screw it all up. And then they came out with a double tape deck. And if your buddy bought an album, like you had a new album come out, I want one album, I want two, and you want two. We each buy one, and then we make copies for each other, right? We did things like that. Well, then this became music got digitized, and it didn't take long before file sharing was created. And we had these sites, and some of you that are younger, you're like, what the hell was Napster? What the hell was LimeWire? Why the hell would you want it? Well, because the reason you're asking that question is because it changed everything, and it made music so affordable that you don't care that you pay a little bit for it. So when music started getting digitized, if you wanted to buy an album that was like $16 for a CD, that used to be a thing, kiddos, and it was on Apple Music and you bought it, it was $16 on Apple Music. Well, people are like, no, wait, fuck this. No. You're not putting it on a disc. You're not printing artwork. You're not shipping it anywhere. There's no inventory. There's no loss against inventory not bought. This is an on-demand. This should not cost us. But they kept the price equal. Well, sites like LimeWire and Napster and all made music easily pirated, for those that don't remember those days. Well, now, if you have Apple Music for, what, $10 a month, you can listen to anything anytime you want ever. You can pull up YouTube and basically hear any song that you ever want to hear. You've got sites like Spotify, iHeartRadio. I use Pandora, even though it's not really an on-demand. It's more of a mix-type system. 80s guys, we like mixtapes, so we have this ongoing mixtape thing going with Pandora. Whatever, it's all cheap, $4, $5, $10 a month. Now, if you have 10 of them, that's expensive, but if you have one or two, it's cheap. And you're like, you know, why do I care about pirating music? Because it didn't take us long to figure out how to strip music out of videos off YouTube, and then we had an MP3 and we could play it where – but they made it so – but why'd they do it? Why did they go to a subscription model for music? Why? Because they were going to die if they didn't compete. So why won't they go back to you have to pay for every single song or whatever, you know? Or you get the song for 99 cents and it lasts for 6 weeks and then it goes away and if you want it again. Why won't they do that? Because we know the solution. We know the solution. If you do this, then the worlds of LimeWire and all will return. So what was LimeWire? LimeWire was like, I had the song, Isaac had the song, JK had the song, and Bill wants the song. And we all would use this one piece of software, and it would take a piece of the song for me, a piece of the song from JK, and a piece of the song from Isaac, and reassemble it for Bill. And the more people that use the network, the more music you could get, and the faster a download and exchange was. And the entire music industry changed forever and never went back. So some of these technologies, and I'm telling you, if you do it right, you can get the centralized providers to give you what you want at a price you're willing to pay, right? Jason Henza says Odyssey hides videos. My understanding is they only hide videos like child porn or legitimate IPR type things. Like, it's my content, you stole it from me, and I complained about it, and I can prove that it's my content. But yes, they can hide videos on Odyssey. But a lot like Noster, they can't actually take them down. They can just hide them. And when I had Jeremy Kaufman on, when Odyssey was really more of a going concern, and he said about like the porn and stuff like that, he goes like, we are a company. We exist. We have names associated with us. If we don't take like clearly illegal things like child porn down, they will put us in prison. Okay, I understand why. But to your point, yes, then it is censorable to a degree. I haven't had a single person tell me, you know, I made a video about subject XYZ that was your video with your content on it that you put there, and Odyssey took it down. I've never even heard of that. I'm not even sure that it would be taking much down anymore because they so destroyed the LBC token and the revenue model that I don't know that it's more than just it just functions kind of as a decentralized model with its own token now on its own. It's more of a coin because it is mined. Now, another one, and I'm interested in getting Alan Booker on the show and Sue to talk to you guys about this, is land race plant and livestock breeding. This is serious technology. And some of the most valuable intellectual property rights in the world today are plant genetics, and animal genetics, honestly. And, of course, what the companies do, like Monsanto, Conagra, Bayer, which is now Monsanto and Bayer are the same, and Syngenta, et cetera, what these companies do is they patent the genetics of a life form, which I think should be completely illegal, but it's not. But that tells you something. If you have a seed for a plant that will grow better, higher yield, et cetera, than those around you, you have something of value. Extensive value, so valuable that they'll take millions of dollars worth of legal fees to patent and defend it. So I'm not at all exalting their process or what they're doing. I think they're horrible people, but they only do it because a genetic stack modified soybean seed has value to farmers, which means anything of superior genetics has value. And land races generally won't just do well on the land that they were developed, but the region they were developed in. In other words, my neighbor's yard, his soil type, et cetera, everything about his property is pretty much the same as mine. And even the guy 10 miles down the road, he might have more soil depth, but that's the same case. When it rains here, it's probably raining there. When it doesn't rain here, it ain't raining there. When it's windy here, when it's sunny here, the same pathogens exist here. The same pests exist. So if we can start building out more of these land race of our seed and our livestock stock, we have a potential to build up a tremendous amount of value, both in production and the value of the genetics themselves. And we need people like Alan, who's putting together an organization to basically put protective patents on any of the genetics that end up being unique enough to be patented. So what a protective patent is, all of us can just keep using it all we want. But if you want to like take that genetic stack and sell it to somebody somewhere else, then you got to pay a license fee. That's a protective patent. Personal use, small use, whatever, go nuts. You want to start putting it in catalogs and selling it to 1,000 different people all over the world, and you either got to pay a fee. But the bigger thing isn't that they have to pay a fee, because I'm sure the fee would be very low and reasonable. You want those genetics distributed. What the protective patent does is it prevents a Syngenta or a Monsanto from coming in and patenting it and then saying you can't use it without paying them. That's the purpose of a protective patent. But that just, again, tells you how valuable these genetics are. And this is, again, an open source technology because it's something anybody can do. If you want to build a land race, all you have to start doing is growing a particular plant and making sure you don't have cross-pollination with other varieties. Or even if you do, you know what they are, so you know what you've done. And grow it for multiple seasons, 7 to 10 seasons. And you have something truly adapted if you are selecting properly. If you're ruthlessly culling anything that's diseased or damaged, you can very quickly develop these seed strains and livestock strains. You know, Alan in his talk used an example of like a black Australope chicken. And one of the things he says, you get one of your black Australopes, American Australopes, and it's got a white feather out of the breeding cycle. Out of the breeding cycle. Now, you don't have to necessarily kill it. You know, but then you better be able to determine that you're not getting eggs from it to continue your breeding program. You might say, I don't have a problem with white. I didn't get to ask him about exactly why, and that I'm sure there was a reason for it, for that particular strain of chicken, why you'd want to eliminate that trait. Whether it's just aesthetics or there's some other thing, I don't know yet, but we'll talk about it when he gets on. But there are plenty of opportunities out there for us to develop these land races. of, again, plant genetics and animal genetics. And with my online program, I'm going to talk to Alan and see if he's interested. I would actually be interested in him doing two courses for home food systems, one on plant genetics and one on livestock genetics. Because I think these are two key critical aspects of things that we need to understand better. And then the next would be open source AI tools and systems. So we had Colonel Miller on last week, and he, you know, when I said that I recommend people learn how to use AI, he looked horrified. And I'm like, I'm sorry, Boomer. There's a lot of things I liked about what he had to say and a lot of things I didn't. But in that case, I'm just thinking, sorry, Boomer. This technology is not going to go away. And you saw he was kind of resigned to it when I said if you outlawed it, everybody would use it anyway. There's no way to stop it. And all you would get is the people you're worried about having access to it, the people you're not worried about not having access to it or having to go through extra steps to have access to it. But the real future in AI is not the ChatGPT type model or the DALL-E model or something like that. It's going to be us running our own AI systems like Guy Swan is doing and teaching people how to do. Because we don't necessarily need an AI system that can do everything and know everything. If you are a group of farmers, you might want an AI system highly tuned into the latest information about how to do things with farming, with natural farming and regenerative agriculture techniques. Well, we can build LLM models that are straight into that. And they're actually going to be way better at it because we're not wasting resources making sure that it also can give you an answer about 16th century French literature or Greek history. And there's nothing wrong with either of those things. Just isn't really relevant. And the beauty of AI models, as we begin to develop more and more algorithms for them, and I understand there's risk, but like I said, there's risk to guns. So if my enemy has a gun, I want a gun. And I want my gun to be as good or better than their gun. If my enemy has a Pew delivery device, I want a Pew delivery device to counteract it. So yes, AI can be dangerous. That's why I want you to use it. But we can actually build these AI tools, and when these algorithms continue to improve, what they're doing differently than people is they'll take approaches to problem solving that humans won't or take us a much longer time to get to, or they can take 20, 30, 100 different approaches at once and then say this is the one that will probably work the best. And I think we are going to be able to use massive amounts of AI technology in the not too distant future to accomplish many, many things, including things like, you know, right now, if someone wants to completely automate the irrigation on their farm, then it can be done. It can be done. There's nothing that prevents you from doing it. It can be done with like Raspberry Pis and shit, right? But it actually takes quite a bit of work to be able to develop the code that will run the thing that you want. But what about like a software AI interface that basically you can maybe just take pictures of your property or take a Google Earth image of your property and click where you want emitters that define certain things, and it writes all the code for you. Okay, and even when it's that easy, there's still going to be people like, I can't do it. There's people that tell me they can't friggin' sign up for Noster and they're on X. If you can be on X, you can be on Noster, right? So what is that opportunity then? That makes the business of installing automated irrigation systems much more approachable to the person who learns the skill set. Just one example. But AI tools are a huge decentralized technology. And again, I know as long as you're relying on like a ChatGPT service, that's not very decentralized, but it's becoming very decentralized very quickly. And it's going to get to somebody can set up two or three gaming computers and do everything they need for themselves and maybe their community. And again, you could tell me it's going to turn into a demon, it's going to take over the traffic system, whatever. All that shit is either going to happen or not going to happen anyway. You using AI will not change that. And if you believe there will, then that's your one that you don't do. And then the last one I have is citizen science. And this is like one of the things I really admire about Matt Powers is he's really teaching people the model of citizen scientist. And he's all focused on soil biology. Like, that's his thing. But any good scientist is going to be highly specialized, right? They might be a generalist, but their real work is going to go into one or two verticals, one or two niches, right? But the model, what does citizen science look like? Citizen science looks like actually believe what they taught you about science in seventh and eighth and ninth grade. Not all the shit they put on TV and call science today. This is why we need citizen science. If scientists were actually doing the work that they should be doing in the holistic way that they should be doing it for the purpose of actually advancing humanity, not advancing oligarchy, we wouldn't need citizen scientists. We would never be able to compete with them. I'm serious. If you think about the amount of money and resources that are available just through the university systems, there shouldn't be even room for citizen scientists today. Not because we can't have value, but because they should be beating us to everything. But they're not. Their weakness, our strength. What I mean by that is, when we even, let's say an ag product, what will be the mandate of all the researchers, all the scientists put behind developing an agricultural system or product? The mandate will be make sure that it works in a way that we can manufacture it and control it and patent it. And you know that will be the mandate. So how much effort are they going to put into figuring out exactly how a healthy food web, food soil food web works? The answer is not much at all. Not much at all. What are you going to patent? What are you going to patent? See, this is one of the problems with all the research that I look at into things like cover crops, things like biochar, things like composting. The scientist of today in the system wants to be able to definitively say, use 5 nanograms per milliliter and you will get X result, period. If they can't quantify the exact amount, application, cost, and output, they throw it away. You can't do that with a biologically diverse system with as many variables as a handful of soil, if it's healthy, has in it. You will never do that. You will never do that. Because there's a billion, trillion, quadrillion life forms in that handful of soil. And they all act on their own self-interest. And so citizen scientists need to look at, if you do these things, is the result beneficial or negative? And what do we think's going on? That's just at the soil level that Matt's doing. But that model works for anything. Developing software, right? If you look at what – I'll tell you the truth. Everybody calls them coders. But all the people building all the shit in the Bitcoin space, especially like the innovative shit like Cashew and stuff like that, they're citizen scientists. They're just doing things that's not biological science. It's computer science. It's economic science. What happens if we do this? I'm not going to write a grant proposal. I'm not going to ask for permission, right? Yeah, imagine trying to do that type of research with the economics of the banking system. What if you? I want to build a new banking. I want to build a new payment system for the banks. Well, first thing you need is permission from the banks. If you want to build a new payment system that involves Bitcoin, you don't need anything. Now, you got to know what you're doing. You got to be able to make it work. But you don't need anybody's – nobody can stop it. Nobody can prevent it. You know what I mean? Like, I really don't like the fact that Isaac YLYL here in the chats developed a way to send Bitcoin fast and cheap that makes my business that circuses, that goes around Lightning, for instance, invalid now. I have to adopt his method because it's so much better. No one can stop that. You think Visa and MasterCard want this done? No. They are the banks. You have to go to them for permission. Can you build on the Visa network? Can you build on the Visa network without an approved account that they give you, a merchant account? Can you integrate Visa into your business? No. You have to be permission-based. Pay their fees, follow their rules, and you can't do anything outside the lines. But with Bitcoin, you can. Those are both forms of citizen science. We need so much citizen science being done. And a great way to understand that, and hopefully I won't get this video taken down over pointing this out, but look at what we did during COVID. It shows you the need for citizen science. I'm not talking about the stabby stabs. I'm not talking about, you know, any of the things that you would normally think of. I'm talking about the fact that there were massive numbers of treatment protocols that were developed by individual doctors. You know, one doctor developed a protocol, wasn't the hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin stuff. It was simply inhaled corticosteroids. And his reasoning, I don't remember his name or the protocol name, but his reasoning was, so I have patients with this new disease that we had never seen before, and their primary complaint was they feel like they can't breathe. So I've been a doctor for 30 years, and I simply asked myself, what do I do when I have a patient who can't breathe well? And one of the first things I try is inhaled steroids because it lets them breathe. So why don't we actually take one of these patients who's having trouble breathing and give them something that should help them breathe and see what happens? So they did it. Turns out works. Guy could breathe, not panicking, getting through the situation, was able to therefore recover more adequately. And he said, hey, I'm not saying this will work for everybody, but for people with mild breathing discomfort who are otherwise going to have like a mild version of this illness, maybe you should do this. And what did they do? They attacked him. Okay, that is science, but in a way it's also citizen science. It's a doctor using empirical evidence gained in the field and then giving that information to other doctors. It was completely shut down. Every doctor that attempted to do anything that didn't line up with what Pfizer et al. Said, with the CDC and the WHO said, if it went any way other than exactly down the line that they defined, that doctor was threatened with losing their license. Pharmacists wouldn't fill their prescriptions. They would be shut off of YouTube or X or what have you by people who are 22-year-olds that know nothing about anything, censoring, now we're back to why we need alternative social media, censoring a degreed doctor, a board-certified physician, in some cases like a board-certified, double board-certified infectious disease specialist being shut down. Okay, what does that have to do with citizen science? What I realized when that happened, as crazy as it seemed that it was going on, when I dug deeper, when I did what I teach you guys, which is pattern recognition, once I knew the pattern to look for, I started reading these books that I had already been reading about scientific concepts and seeing the pattern that I didn't see before. Oh, shit, there it is. Now, once you see it, you can't not see it. So when I read a book on invasive species and I saw the way scientists gilded and protected the viewpoint, all invasive species are bad, it's the same thing. You don't know anything. Because when you have a predetermined outcome, it's not science. It's not science. And, you know, when I look at diet and nutrition, and I look at what Ken Berry was teaching and Sean Baker's teaching, Thomas DeLore teaching, and I'm like, okay, this carnivore keto thing seems like it works really well. And then when you look at the way it was being combated by the powers that be, same thing. Same pattern. Same established pattern. The person who goes on a diet, no matter what kind of diet it is, that fully records what they do and records their lab work, records their weight, et cetera, how they feel, their ability physically, et cetera, to like exercise and gain muscle mass, that records it all in a formulaic way and reports their results is as much a citizen scientist as Matt Powers is when he publishes a incredibly awesome image of a plant exploding a microbe to eat it. They're both equal as scientists. They have different value in what they reported, but they're following the same program. We test, we record, and we report so that others can take our data and see if they can replicate it. That's why I say all you have to do to be a citizen scientist is believe what they taught you in like in junior high and high school and then go do it. Now, I don't know what they're teaching today. They might be teaching the scientific method is turn the TV on and do what the news guy says. I don't know if they actually teach the scientific method. I don't know if they actually teach what forming a hypothesis is and experimental control. I don't know if they do that, but if they do, that's all you got to do. If not, it's all available. Look it up. And we need citizen scientists pulling at not just basically everything in the known universe and more, but especially in the things we talked about today. We need citizen scientists determining what is the most effective platform model for remote learning. We should be doing that. Or how many ways can we utilize the heat from Bitcoin mining rigs? That's another citizen scientist project. Cover cropping, I'd like to believe I'm participating in that. Composting, I'd like to believe that I'm participating in that. But I'm not enough. You know, biochar, definitely know I'm participating in how many ways can we make it out of how many things and how many ways can we use it. The amount of science that can be done just with charcoal. And it's something mankind has had for almost as long. I would say mankind has been using charcoal in one form or another that predates writing. The earliest absolutely confirmed use of charcoal by humans is cave drawings. We actually think it's much older than that, but that's the oldest confirmed use, and that's about 30,000 years ago. Humans were using charcoal to draw on cave walls 30,000 years ago, and we still don't have a freaking clue all the things we can do with it. I think that's pretty cool, and that's an opportunity for citizen scientists. Hydroculture, whether it's aquaculture, aquaponics, hydroponics, whatever. Like, how much can we do with that? How much citizen science room is there in that? And you know who's best at this? Kids. Teenagers, young 20s. They have still that inquisitive, I want to know, I want to fuck with it, I want to pull it apart. More than me. And I have it probably to the point where it's actually a problem in my life because I'm empowered to play with it all. And I play with too many things at one time. I know I do that. Scientists need to be focused on one or two things at a time. And I mean, you want to make sure your kids get a great education. Give them a citizen science project. Not a science project for school. You do this little thing, you put it in the ball, and you put a little little port, you put it in the science fair. A long-term citizen science objective to achieve and help them with it. Help them with it. Land rice plants, mesh networks, solar and wind, Noster-based. Like I said, the people doing all the development on Noster, they're all citizen scientists. They're just engineering is their and software development, right? That's their science of choice. Do you know that we have a job board on Noster? Nobody's using it. I don't think there's enough network effect yet. But if people just started using it more and it wasn't all Bitcoin postings, we might actually start having a network effect with it, right? There's actually a Noster platform that replaces Substack, completely uncensorable. You think of anything you can do online today, there's a Noster equivalent for it. That's citizen science. That's why I put it last. I think it's a good anchor point. With that, let's take a few questions, and then we'll wrap up. Question, finished Q, how feasible is it to make from cocoa core? Finished Q, I don't know. I don't know what that is, so I'm sorry. Same guy asking another question. Maybe this expands on it. I have sourced waste stream through Cannabis Grow Farm. They turn out 144-gallon grow pots filled with cocoa core that I can pick up this amount every 10 days. So he's asking, cocoa core that was used in a hydroponics system to grow cannabis, I guess he's asking about composting it. I guess you're asking that. It would be a carbon. It would have to be treated like a carbon. It would have some residual nutrient in it, but you would need to bring in nitrogen to compost it. It would also be a great carbonized material. Coco coir would make a good biochar. Would it be as good agriculturally as something like a hardwood or a softwood or even something like corn stover or bamboo? Probably not, but it would still be a damn good material, especially since you can get it for free. And it would carbonize really, really easily in a retort model like the 10-man retort, if that's what. So I'm not really sure what you're asking. If you want to add to it, dude, I'll take a look on the other side before I wrap up. Nurse Wang says, I made a bioreactor compost bin with fresh wood chips and rabbit manure. If it doesn't heat up to ideal temps, can I add liquid nitrogen source until it does? Here's the thing about bioreactor. I don't know if you've taken the course, dude, but if it doesn't heat up to ideal temperatures, you don't have to do anything. It's still going to work. It's still going to work. When we build a good bioreactor, we should hit peak temperature if it's going to hit peak temperature within about 3 days. It might go up a little more after that. It might not. It can make the entire temperature cycle in 10 days. It could take 20 days. It could take 25 days. It could be anywhere in there. This is a biological living system. How long do we age it? For a year. How important is the thermophilic component of that cycle to that 1 year? It's not. It's not high turn. It's not always going to heat up really, really hot. It's not always going to get up in like 140, 150 degree range. It's okay. And bioreactor composting, here's the secret. It's a mix of biological digestion and worm farming is really what it is. And that's why it gets that consistency that's just amazing when it's wet, that'll actually like coat your hands and wash off the way biochar does. So if you have anything to add to that question, again, you can do follow-up with it. Isaac says, how viable is growing freshwater mussels in your own pond or stream? In a stream, it might be pretty viable if the stream is really clean water. In a pond, it might be okay. In the end, there's a reason it's not an industry. It will, you know, anything that's growing shells like that is going to pull calcium out of the water. So unless you have a good amount of calcium bioavailable in the first place, it's difficult to get good growth. The other thing is, what are they? What are bivalves? They're filter feeders. And so they will take up any, that's part of what makes them great for cleaning up degraded ecosystems, but then not being a viable food source. So sadly, much of the water, freshwater systems in North America today produce highly polluted mussels and clams, which didn't used to be the case. It was a huge food source for early settlers and prior to that Native Americans. So I've not seen anybody doing it. It's something I've definitely thought about. I've looked at it a little bit, and in systems my size, it is not viable at all. If you want to do something that's more of a shellfish-like thing, like one of the things that works really well is like freshwater shrimp, freshwater prawns, things like that are very doable. The bottleneck there is breeding, and there's some great work being done to increase the amount of fry available for commercial and small commercial operations. I would say that probably the thing that would be mostly like anybody can do it anywhere is going to be something to do with crayfish. Whether you get your hands, if you figure out how to breed them on some of like what they call gabbies out of Australia, New Zealand, which are like, they're crayfish, but they're like the size of small lobsters. And there's some that are even bigger than that, but I've never seen anybody successfully get them into the United States. Or straight up just regular crayfish that you can go out and trap and then move into your water that you control. Be careful with them in impoundments, though, because they make burrows and problems and water drains and stuff like that. Or systems like mine, you can definitely grow them. I'm playing around with right now, and I really need to get some more because I did something, not dumb, but it's harder for me to know if I'm being successful short term with. But the marble crayfish, which are self-replicating, and they're a bit small compared to crayfish that are normally marketed as a food source here in America, but they are an incredibly utilized food source in Madagascar. So in Madagascar, they initially started playing with them. These are the self-replicating. So they do not need a female or a male. They're all asexual. They're all self. They're all clones. And so you put one of these things in a tank and you feed it right. And as long as it gets enough nutrient, all of a sudden it forms berries and makes babies. Well, now in Madagascar, because there really isn't something that fills their niche, like people have been worried about them becoming a problem in North America. Well, if you go to any place in North America, crayfish are something eats crayfish. And while it's easier for us from a self-replication standpoint, it's not like crayfish in North America don't reproduce in huge numbers, right? So they haven't caused any problem anywhere in North America. And again, if you understand the whole system, it's highly unlikely that not all invasives are bad, right? It's not like they don't have natural predators. What eats crayfish? Everything. Bass eat crayfish. Cat feet eat crayfish. On shorelines, raccoons, possums, et cetera, eat crayfish. It's not like, you know, the fire ant became a problem in North America because nothing eats fire ants. By the way, somebody was telling me on my YouTube channel last week about using fire ants for feed for quail. Don't use fire ants for feed. They're like, they don't eat them. I'm glad they didn't. Fire ants have so much formic acid in them that they're actually toxic to just about anything that would eat them. That's why nothing eats them, including their larva also have this. So, and part of that is like all ants have some amount of formic acid. The Latin name for ant is formica, formica, right? So the ant and the grasshopper, the grasshopper and the formica, right? He's the ant. So just know that. But I don't think you're going to get very far with mussels or clams. I haven't seen anybody ever do that. And again, any toxins that wouldn't even end up in your fish or what have you are going to end up in bivalves. So that's why a lot of the southern seacoast, they have an oyster industry, but there's harvesting times, and it's not about making sure that they're not over-harvested. It's they're literally dangerous in the summer, and they're only harvested for feed in the winter because of things like red tides and stuff like that. Builder of Castles says, they say those citizen scientists are unscientific. This is a comment. However, the cancer industry doesn't use data if the patient is too far gone, too old, too young, too rare, too low on T levels too. So yeah, I mean, this is the thing about the modern science industry. They say we're unscientific when we do our own little experiments and report our results and things like that. But what is more scientific than recording all your variables and publishing your results and saying to anybody anywhere, go ahead, tear it apart. Tell me what I did wrong. Tell me if you get it. I mean, that is science. What they have is a gilded, protected output system, which by its nature can't be science. And what I mean by that is they just, when they trial a drug, well, they don't want too high a fatality, right? So they look at anybody and go, you're probably going to die. You're not in this trial. They've been caught so many times, it's unbelievable, where people did get in the trial, did die, and then they retroactively removed them from the sample under some auspice of they should have never been included in the first place, or we no longer recommend it for people who like have blonde hair or some shit. I mean, it's almost that bad. Do you know this little factoid? So we need the government to protect us from companies that would give us drugs that would be harmful to us instead of helpful to us. Do you know what percentage of FDA-approved drugs are either removed, restricted, or issued a warning that was not issued upon approval within 10 years after initial approval? What percentage of drugs has that happened? Like basically like we're pulling it off the market, or you know, you can still use this, but don't use it if you have one of these five conditions that we didn't know about initially, or like you can use it, but it's far more dangerous than we thought. 25%. 1 in 4 drugs approved by the FDA are eventually either recalled or have very significant additional warnings added to them. So, yeah, don't tell us about science, guys. You don't know anything about science. The science for them is now a defensive gilding versus an error detecting process. The most pure form of science in the world is full documentation of procedure, reporting of results into the wild. And then it's up to anybody else to convince themselves that what you've reported is valid or invalid and to defend their position and have open academic debate. I'm sorry, your little extra initials after your name and all don't make you that much more important. I mean, I'm trying to think of how to do a show about this. Without it sounding insulting, I want to do a show that's something along the lines of Gen Z's. This is why everybody thinks that even when you're educated, you're an idiot. Because of how much they don't know when they are highly credentialed. I love all the ag stuff, permaculture stuff and everything, and biochar is one of my passions. And as I'm building this biochar course, I'm consuming tons of information that will never make it in the course. Like, because it's sometimes you get this one little obscure thing and you're like, I'm going to pull on that thread and it leads back to somewhere else. And like, wow, this is key, right? So I'm listening to this one recently and this girl, she has a master's degree. Her world is mycology, actually, and soil remediation. But she did her master's thesis on biochar. I'm like, this is cool. And I'm sorry, but she came off like a dingbat. She did not sound like she was in command of what she was doing. and she didn't sound like she was sure of anything. She was one of those people that even when she was sure of something, she spoke like a question. And God, I got to tell you, if that is you, you need to fucking rein that in if you want people to take you seriously, especially like in a hardcore academic, business world, political, whatever. Like, I don't take people seriously that are like, well, you should use like a .30-06 with like a 150 grain bullet. Like, I'm like, so you don't fucking know what you're talking about. That was one of her problems. But this girl actually knew a lot about biochar that was accurate and a lot that I'm not really sure about. And you could see it was the science, which is more conditioning, training, and gilding, that was getting in the way of true science that would lead to at least educated hypothesis. Like, it's like beyond a base hypothesis. Like, we really think this does do this thing because here's the results we got. We're not ready to say conclusively yet, but it sure looks like that was being held back. But she didn't know some of the most basic shit that I knew that had nothing to do with biochar. Like the waste streams out of the coffee industry that she was using to make biochar in freaking Puerto Rico. So she goes to Puerto Rico. She lives for 6 months at a coffee plantation that's doing everything. So they're growing the coffee. They're cleaning the beans. They're curing the beans. They're roasting the beans. And then they're shipping them. So they're doing end to end. And they're even doing some, like, there's a cafe there, so like you can literally go drink coffee that was grown right there, and everything was done internally. Plus, there can like, but she didn't even understand that what she was actually making biochar out of wasn't the crack from the roasting process; it was the coating on the berries. When you pick a coffee bean, and what you actually roast is the seed, the outside is a fruit; it's red, and that's the material she was working with. She didn't even know that. She didn't know what she was working with. And you would have only known that if you knew what she was working with, because when she described it in a very awkward way, you figured that out. Okay, don't lecture us on science. I'm sorry. This person's on paper way more educated than me. But because I've actually done independent research with biochar and because I know fucking the cold sauce, right? I knew that she didn't know what she was talking about. Don't lecture us on science. I'm done being lectured on science by people that wouldn't know science if it bit them in the ass. Woodhaven Orchards. If I can keep a small part of my bioreactor warm for the freezing months of the year, would the continued fungal process spread to the rest of the pile in spring? Well, yes, but no, because you're not going to. When you build a bioreactor, you're going to get a defined period based on what you put in there of heat, and it won't be very long. It's on the outside, longest potential 30 days, there'll be some residual warmth in there, where you still have a little bit of NC bonding going on in the center, and you know, everything else is like 50 degrees, but that one spot with the thermometer, you'll find like an 85 degree area. It's not long duration. It's not that kind of compost. It's not high turn. It's no turn. It's minimal disturbance. So the only way that you could harness the heat from a bioreactor is to know that whatever you're like, what I use, I'm at high heat in 2 days. I'm at peak heat in 3 to 4 days. And I am ebbing off and not really releasing any heat at about 20. That's my coop mix with my other amendments. That's what I get in my climate with my method. And I know that. If I have enough material available, I could conceivably, let's say I wanted to heat a greenhouse, and I had two rows going down both sides, one on each side of a greenhouse, and that open in the middle. I could build a bioreactor in that spot in the middle as long as I left enough room to walk around it and work in the greenhouse. And then, you know, I would probably want to build it on the far side of the greenhouse so it's not in the way of the next one, and then build another one and another one and another one. And knowing I can get about 20 days, I could probably keep heat in that greenhouse from that approach for, 80 days? And in my climate, if I started it when I'm going to get my first good hard freezes, which are January, that could take me out to March. I'm probably good. Maybe I need one more. So then I could do, 100 days? 100 days here of heat in a greenhouse and I'm good. But would that work for you? Well, I don't know. I don't know. Now, the same person said, it freezes where I live. If I keep the middle of my bioreactor warm with a chicken water plate heater, with the fungal types being built, I guess what he's saying is, if you can keep, can you basically keep a little reservoir of biology in there? Yeah, and I thought I put that in the course. I picked that up from Steven Reisner. Steven Reisner says to use an aquarium heater, like a 300-watt aquarium heater set on the lowest setting, bury it in the center. It will, it first of all, it's designed to get wet. It's not going to, you know, except where the plug goes in, you have to do something to protect the plug. So you have to have electrical power. Okay. But you could just basically take a here's what I do. If I need to protect a plug that's going to be outside and exposed to rain and stuff, I take that plug and I take a plastic Ziploc bag and I cut a hole on both sides of it so you can come in from the side. And then I push the air out and I roll it around the linkage. And then I tape both ends with you know, waterproof tape. That's what I do. Never had a problem. I don't know, some electrical engineer might tell me I'm going to start a fire or something. I've never had a problem. They also make casings that do the same thing, but I've always found that to work, and it's immediately expedient. So you do have to worry about where you're plugging in. Anything outside should be going to a GFI anyway. But the part you're burying, it doesn't matter. It's, again, you stick them in water, in fish tanks. Most of them are designed, and you can make sure you buy one that is, where even if the top part where you set it all, the whole thing can be submerged. It's not a problem. So now you've got this area. Now, it's not going to keep the whole thing from freezing, but it is going to keep a core. And I think what he's asking is, will then when it thaws back out, the biology continue its job and kind of recolonize? Yes, it will. Yes, it will. And that's exactly what we recommend to do. And I really thought we put that into the course after I got that information. I got one more and I'm going to have to go, guys. Mark says, activated charcoal for a water filter. Will the stuff made for agriculture work? It says it's kosher certified, so I assume it's good. Kosher is about how things are done and what's not done and what it doesn't touch. So kosher doesn't mean good unless it means good to you based on what it means for that product. I have a hard time understanding how any charcoal wouldn't be kosher unless somebody did something to it they're not supposed to, or used something on it they're not supposed to. Here's the difference between activated charcoal and biochar. Activated charcoal is much more a higher end, more refined product with things like known particle sizes and things like that. Okay. Will biochar work as a water filter? Yes. It just won't work as good as activated charcoal. So it all depends on, you know, this would be something that you'd need testing on. But definitely one of the things in the biochar course is going to be about how once you have the ability to make charcoal, you do have the ability to filter water. You have other things you can filter with charcoal too, right? And the thing is, so you can run more filter, right, or more processes or more filtering passes because you make the charcoal for yourself and you can still reuse it. I honestly don't know how what I'm about to say would affect it for agricultural use. You might want to come up with one of the other uses for it if you did this with it. But one of the things you can do with charcoal is you can filter moonshine and make it smoother. So a lot of guys with their still setups, what they'll do is they'll come down to a tube, and that tube is full of charcoal. And then that tube empties into what's called a distiller's parent. And a distiller, so you can look one up if you don't know what it is. It's something that lets you proof your whiskey as it's being produced. So you put a hydrometer in it and it has an overflow, kind of like a sill in a swale, and then it comes out what looks like the parrot's beak, and that goes into your collection vessel. So as it's running, you can sit there and go, right now we're running really, really high proof. You pull your heads off, you know, and then you see your proof start to fall. You pull your tails and you call your run, and you could pitch back into your next run. But they're running it through charcoal, so they're already taking out some of the less desirable flavors. That's another thing you can do with charcoal. You can absolutely use any good charcoal that you've made for a water filter, but how good will be something would need to be tested. And you would need to test that by testing the water before and after filtration and seeing the difference. little bit of citizen science work there, but there's a lot of different water filter designs out there that utilize charcoal, sand, gravel, and multiple steps in things. So it's definitely something you can do, but I can't tell you exactly how or what to do for your situation. I don't know the water you're starting with. I don't know the water you're starting with. I don't know what potential contaminants are in the water you're starting with, and I don't know how much rigor is needed to make sure that that water is safe. And I don't know, are you filtering it to drink or are you filtering it for some other reason? There could be lots of reasons that you're filtering it. Is filtering the only thing you're doing? Right? If you're filtering it because you want to reduce propensity of things like heavy metals and all, charcoal's really good at that. Charcoal's really good at that. But some biologics may get through. So if you're boiling and filtering, it's different than if you're just filtering. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Let me remind you guys, if you like the show and the work that we do, one of the things you can do to help us out is do your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day, John Dowie made fun of me. He said it's a boomer item of the day because he likes his outlet things to work on voice control or with Alexa or something like that. I'm not big on the CIA hearing everything I have to say in the privacy of my own home, John, but you can go ahead and do that. But no, seriously, I think there is a place for on-demand, on and off, when you want it, with a simple remote control and being able to control five devices for $20, $25, pretty damn useful. So these are made by a company called Syantec, S-Y-A-N-T-E-K, some Chinese company. But I found these when the little remote I have in my hand right now is made by eTech City. And eTech City made some that were a little bit bigger on the other end from what you're looking at right now. But I really liked them, and they worked really good for a number of years. I used them for some things other than what they were bought for, which was for my wife's Christmas lights. So last year, she's like, just get another set of them. Because I'm like, well, I'll go get the one. And she's like, leave it where it is. Get another set. They're cheap. I went to get them, and eTech City didn't make them anymore. And I did a bunch of research, and these were the best replacement that I found. We use these. They work fantastic. The remotes just have an on and off for each number. Each device has a little number. You plug it in the wall. You plug something into it, and you can turn it on and off with a switch. I have them in my back shop. I have two box fans, like $30 cheapo box fans, hanging from the roof. I go in there, turn, click on, boom, fans run. Turn them off, fans stop. That keeps the shop nice and cool. I have Christmas lights in the rafters of my main shop where we do the workshop. And I have LED lights. LED lights are on an off switch on the wall, like any other light, but they're really, really bright. And there's times I don't want that. So we have more like a mood lighting thing. It'd be nice to have a wedding in there when those are on. They're so nice. We have a lamp that's kind of in a really shitty place behind the couch. We don't really anymore, but when I first got them, we did. I used them there on and off. I used to use them for my fish tanks. Now those I put on timers. And see, timers are great when you know I wanted to come on at this time and go off at that time. But when you want something you can turn on and off whenever you want, this is one of like those low-tech, easy automation things, totally worth the $25. And I brought it around because we're headed to what? The holidays. I know we haven't even gotten knocked, Halloween yet, but, it'll be next month, and you'll be doing Christmas decoration if you do Christmas decoration. No wonder John hated these. He's a Grinch. He doesn't even like Christmas. I don't understand people that don't like Christmas. Next up today, real quick, fits in with today's show. Home food systems. We have a ton of courses available. Well, three. It's not really a ton, but we keep adding more and more. We have the principle-based course, principle-based design course. It's absolutely free. The composting course, the cover crop course, and right now in develop the biochar course. So those are going to be our core, and we'll build out from there. If you haven't yet taken a course at Home Food Systems, please give us a try. That's why I made a course that I could easily sell for $40-$50 for free. That's why I did that. So that you could kick the tires and see if it was the right thing for you. If you like my teaching style when I'm in a more academic setting than just a podcast, check it out today, homefoodsystems.com. With that, we're ready to wrap up. Again, tomorrow, it's an Unloose the Goose reunion for those that remember Unloose the Goose. If you don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. It'll be a podcast episode for Survival Podcast as well. I, Nicole Saw, C.J. Kilmer, and John Bush getting together to pregame the election and the aftermath, regardless of who wins, with four very different opinions. Like, you'll find one thing about the four of us. We all get along. We all like each other. We get a lot in common. We do not think uniformly, and we shouldn't, not for a group project like that. That's right. Hey, Alabama says honk. Yep, the geese are back. And then Wednesday, CJ will be joining me for a discussion on parallels between the collapse of the Soviet Union and the current state of the United States government and the United States as an empire. And then we got the rest of the week as regular. And then we got one more week that I'll be doing regularly scheduled programming before we have the event week for the workshop. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that Unloose the Goose reunion. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, the others will follow. The revolution.